The Last American, a fragment from the journal of Khan Li, Prince of Dinfyuchur and Admiral in the Persian Navy, presented by J. A. Mitchell, copyright 1899. Preface. A few words by Headful, surnamed The Axis of Wisdom, curator of Imperial Museum at Shiraz, author of The Celestial Conquest of California and of Northern Mexico under the Hibernian rulers. The astounding discoveries of Khan Li of Dinfyuchur have thrown floods of light upon the domestic life of the American people. He little realized when he landed upon that sleeping continent what a service he was about to render history, or what enthusiasm his discoveries would arouse among Persian archaeologists. Every student of antiquity is familiar with these facts, but for the benefit of those who have yet to acquire a knowledge of this extraordinary people, I advise first a visit to the museum at Tehran in order to excite their interest in the subject, and second, the reading of such books as Nofulus, What We Found in the West, and Nos Italis, History of the Americans. The last named is a complete and reliable history of these people from the birth of the Republic under George Washington to the year 1990, when they ceased to exist as a nation. I must say, however, that Nos Italis leaves the reader much confused concerning the period between the massacre of the Protestants in 1927 and the overthrow of the Murphy dynasty in 1940. He holds the opinion with many other historians that the Americans were a mongrel race, with little or no patriotism, and were purely imitative, simply an enlarged copy of other nationalities extant at the time. He pronounces them a shallow, nervous, extravagant people, and accords them but few redeeming virtues. This, of course, is just, but nevertheless they will always be an interesting study by reason of their rapid growth, their vast numbers, their marvelous mechanical ingenuity, and their sudden and almost unaccountable disappearance. The wealth, luxury, and gradual decline of the native population, the frightful climatic changes which swept the country like a mower's scythe, and the rapid conversion of a vast continent alive with millions of pleasure-loving people into a silent wilderness, where the sun and moon look down in turn upon hundreds of weed-grown cities, all this is told by Nos Italis with force and accuracy. Aboard the Zlotub in the year 2951, 10th of May. There is land ahead. Griptila was first to see it, and when he shouted the tidings, my heart beat fast with joy. The famished crew had forgotten their disconsolate stomachs and are dancing about the deck. 'Tis not I, forsooth, who shall restrain them. A month of emptiness upon heavy sea is preparation for any folly. Nofull alone is without enthusiasm. The old man's heart seems dead. We can see the land plainly, a dim strip across the western horizon. A fair wind blows from the northeast, but we will get on with cruel hindrance, for the Zlotub is a heavy ship, her bluff bow and voluminous bottom ill-fitting her for speed. The land as we near it seems covered with trees, and with the white breakers along the yellow beach are a welcome sight. May 11th. Sighted a fine harbor this afternoon, and are now at anchor in it. Gittila thinks we have reached one of the western islands mentioned by Benabout. Nofull, however, is sure we are further north. May 12th. What a change has come over Nofull! He is the youngest man aboard. We all share his delight, as our discoveries are truly marvelous. This morning, while I was yet in my bunk, he ran into the cabin and, forgetting our difference in rank, seized me by the arm and tried to drag me out. His excitement so had the better of him that I captured little meaning from his words. Hastening after him, however, I was amazed to see such ancient limbs transport a man so rapidly. He skipped up the narrow stairs like a heifer, and, young though I am, it was faster than I could follow. What a sight when I reached the deck! We saw nothing of it yesterday, for the dusk of evening was already closing about us when we anchored. Right ahead, in the middle of the bay, towered a gigantic statue, many times higher than the masts of our ship. Beyond, from behind the statue, came the broad river upon whose waters we were floating, its surface all aglitter with the rising sun. To the east, where Nofull was pointing, his fingers trembling with excitement, lay the ruins of an endless city. It stretched far away into the land beyond, further even than our eyes could see. And in the smaller river on the right stood two colossal structures, rising high in the air and standing like twin brothers, as if to guard the deserted streets beneath. Not a sound reached us, not a floating thing disturbed the surface of the water. Verily, it seemed the sleep of death. I was lost in wonder. As we looked, a strange bird, like a heron, arose with a hoarse cry from the foot of the great image and flew toward the city. "What does it all mean?" I cried. "Where are we?" "Where, indeed?" said Nofull. "If I knew but that, O Prince, I could tell the rest. No traveler has mentioned these ruins. Persian history contains no record of such a people. Allah has decreed that we discover a forgotten world." Within an hour we landed and found ourselves in an ancient street and pavements covered with weeds, grass, and flowers, all crowding together in wild neglect. Huge trees of great antiquity thrust their limbs through the windows and roofs and produced a mournful sight. They gave a welcome shade, however, as we found the heat ashore of a roasting quality most hard to bear. The curious buildings on either side are wonderfully preserved, even sheets of glass still standing in many of the iron window frames. We wandered through the thick grass, Nofull and I, much excited over our discoveries and delighted with the strange scene. The sunshine is of dazzling brightness, birds are singing everywhere, and the ruins are gay with gorgeous wild flowers. We soon found ourselves in what was once a public square, now for the most part a shady grove. As we sat on a fallen cornice and gazed on the lofty buildings about us, I asked Nofull if he was still in ignorance as to where we were. He said, "As yet I know not. The architecture is much like that of ancient Europe, but it tells us nothing." Then I said to him in jest, "Let this teach us, O Nofull, the folly of excessive wisdom. Who among thy pupils of the Imperial College at Isfahan could believe their venerable instructor in history and languages could visit the largest city in the world and know so little about it?" "Thy words are wise, my prince," he answered. "Few babes could know less." As we were leaving this grove, my eyes fell upon an upturned slab that seemed to have a meaning. It was lying at our feet, partly hidden by the tall grass, having fallen off from the columns that supported it. Upon its surface were strange characters in bold relief, as sharp and clear as when chiseled 10 centuries ago. I pointed it out to Nofull, and we bent over it with eager eyes. It was this: Astor House.
"The inscription is Old English," he said. "House signified a dwelling, but the word Astor I know not. It is probably the name of a deity, and here was his temple."
This was encouraging, and we looked about eagerly for other signs. Our steps soon brought us into another street, and as we walked I expressed my surprise at the wonderful preservation of the stonework, which looked as though cut but yesterday.
"In such an atmosphere, decay is slow," said Nofull. "A 1,000 years, at least, have passed since these houses were occupied. Take yonder oak, for instance. The tree itself has been growing for at least 100 years, and we know from the fallen mass beneath it that centuries had gone by before this birth was possible."
He stopped speaking, his eyes fixed upon an inscription over a doorway, partly hidden by one of the branches of the oak. Turning suddenly upon me with a look of triumph, he exclaimed,
"It is ours!"
"What is ours?" I asked.
"The knowledge we sought."
And he pointed to the inscription.
"New York, Stock X." He was tremulous with joy. "Thou hast heard of New York, O my prince?"
I answered that I had read of it at school.
"Thou art in it now," he said. "We are standing on the western continent. Little wonder we thought our voyage long."
"And what was New York?" I asked. "I read of it at college, but remember little. Was it not the capital of the ancient Americans?"
"Not the capital," he answered, "but their largest city. Its population was 4 millions.
4 millions, I exclaimed.
"Verily, O fountain of wisdom, that is many for one city." "Such is history, my prince. Moreover, as thou knowest, it would take us many days to walk this town."
"True, it is endless," he
It continued thus. Strange that a single word can tell so much. These iron structures, the huge statue in the harbor, the temples with pointed towers, are all as writ in history. Whereupon I repeated that I knew little of the Americans save what I had learned at college, a perfunctory and fleeting knowledge, as there were people who interested me but little. "Let us seat ourselves in the shade," said Nofor, "and I will tell thee of them." We sat. "For 11 centuries the cities of the sleeping hemisphere have decayed in solitude. Their very existence has been forgotten. The people who built them have long since passed away, and their civilization is but a shadowy tradition. Historians are astounded that a nation of 100 million beings should vanish from the earth like a mist, and leave so little behind. But to those familiar with their lives and their character, surprise is impossible. There was nothing to leave. The Americans possessed neither literature, art, nor music of their own. Everything was borrowed. The very clothes they wore were copied with ludicrous precision from the models of other nations. They were a sharp, restless, quick-witted, greedy race, given body and soul to the gathering of riches. Their chiefest passion was to buy and sell. Even women, both of high and low degree, spent much of their time at bargains, crowding and jostling each other in vast marts of trade. For their attire was complicated and demanded most of their time. How degrading, I exclaimed. So it must have been, said Nofo. But they were not without virtues. Their domestic life was happy. A man had but one wife, and treated her as his equal. That is curious. But as I remember, they were a people of elastic honor. They were so considered, said Nofo. Their commercial honor was a jest. They were sharper than Turks. Prosperity was their god, with cunning and invention for his profits. Their restless activity no Persian can comprehend. This vast country was alive with noisy industries. The nervous Americans darting with inconceivable rapidity from one city to another by a system of locomotion we can only guess at. There existed roads with iron rods upon them, over which small houses on wheels were drawn with such velocity that a long day's journey was accomplished in an hour. Enormous ships without sails, driven by a mysterious force, bore hundreds of people at a time to the furthermost points of the earth. And are these things lost? I asked. We know many of the forces, said Nofo, but the knowledge of applying them is gone. The very elements seem to have been their slaves. Cities were illuminated at night by artificial moons whose radiance eclipsed the moon above. Strange devices were used by which they conversed together when separated by a journey of many days. Some of these appliances exist today in Persian museums. The superstitions of our ancestors allowed their secrets to be lost during those dark centuries from which we are at last waking. At this point, we heard the voice of Bozjakaz in the distance. They had found a spring, and he was calling to us. Such heat we had never felt, and it grew hotter each hour. Near the river, where we ate, it was more comfortable, but even there the perspiration stood upon us in great drops. Our faces shone like fishes. It was our wish to explore further, but the streets were like ovens, and we returned to the Zlotob. As I sat upon the deck this afternoon, recording the events of the morning in this journal, Bozjakaz and Adelpate approached, asking permission to take the small boat and visit the great statue. Thereupon Nofol informed us that this statue in ancient times held aloft a torch illuminating the whole harbor, and he requested Adelpate to try and discover how the light was accomplished. They returned toward evening with this information, that the statue is not of solid bronze, but hollow, that they ascended by means of an iron stairway into the head of the image, and from the top looked down upon us, that Adalpate, in the dark, sat to rest himself upon a nest of yellow flies with black stripes, that these flies inserted stings into Adalpate's person, causing him to exclaim loudly and descend the stairs with unexpected agility, that Bozjakaz and the others pushed on through the upraised arm and stood at last upon the bronze torch itself, that the city lay beneath them like a map, covering the country for miles away on both sides of the river. As for illuminating the harbor, Bozjakaz says no fool is mistaken. There are no vestiges of anything that could give a light, no vessel for oil or traces of fire. No fool says Jakaz is an idiot, that he shall go himself. A few historical notes about the section I just read. The author was John Ames Mitchell, who was born in 1845 and died in 1918. He went to Harvard Medical School, but he dropped out to go abroad and study architecture. He was also an illustrator, and he did some of the illustrations in this book. In 1883, he founded Life magazine, and
sort of ironic thing is he's criticizing American culture, but Life magazine, under his watch, helped set some of the middle class styles and attitudes of the time. The Astor House that the characters in the book find, it was originally called the Park Hotel. It was a six-story hotel created in 1836. It was built by John Jacob Astor. He was America's first multimillionaire. He made his riches via furs, real estate, and opium. The Astor House was across from the City Hall. By the time this book was written, it was already considered old-fashioned and unappealing and mostly used just for business travelers, and it was demolished in 1926. A footnote in the book reveals that the open space that the characters find was City Hall Park. And, of course, the statue they find is Statue of Liberty, which was finished in 1886, so not too long before the book was written. It did function briefly as a lighthouse. Between 1886 and 1902, there was an electric light in the torch run by a power-generating plant on the Liberty Island itself. It was the first electric lighthouse in the country. And, obviously, the building they find... New York Stock is the New York Stock Exchange, which is still in use today, the same building that was in use way back then, even though in 1920 a bomb killed 33 people and injured hundreds more, and right outside that building, and did some damage to that building. Exactly who was behind the bombing was never fully ascertained, but despite that bombing, that same building is still in use today for the New York Stock Exchange. I should also note that the inventions that are talked about, the American inventions, the telephone and electric lights, were things that were created during John Ames Mitchell's lifetime and only recently came into popular use. Of course, the locomotive was around a lot longer than that.